Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Larkin, Judge Brett Wolfman, Honorable Jennifer Frisch.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Welcome, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is April 24, 2024. We have one case on our calendar today. Jill Marie Zetterwald versus State of Minnesota, file number A231525. We are at Central High School in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is very special for me because my daughter is a graduate of Central High School and had Mrs. McCleary for several classes. And we're really excited. Judge Brackle and Judge Larkin, and on behalf of our Chief Judge, Susan Siegel, we're very excited to be here to do this, handle this case in front of all. Before we begin today, I do have a few thank yous and then a few announcements for the attorneys. First, I want to thank Principal Ayers for inviting us here. Thank you so much. The custodial staff for setting up the stage, Mr. Oyen and Mr. Federer for help with the auditorium space, Mr. Knox for mic and audio and tech support, our athletic director, Ms. E, for the tablecloths, Sunny Case, and the parent committee for the support of the meet and greet. Thank you so much. It was very nice this morning. Our incredible, delightful student guides and student ushers. Thank you so much. And of course, Mrs. McCleary for organizing all of this for you today. We do have some special guests today that I want to acknowledge. We have some officials from the district. And the school board, thank you so much for being here. And also Judge Stephen Smith, who is my former colleague in the Second Judicial District. Thank you so much for coming today. And we're very excited to be here. I also want to thank our staff from the Minnesota Judicial Center, Mrs. Finney, who has been an incredible support for us, and our two state troopers who are here to keep us safe and to protect us. I just want to remind you all that these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted today. No phones, no video, no audio. So please, if you have that information, don't act on it because those troopers might take your phone. I don't want that to happen. All right. I also want to thank our two advocates today, Ms. Rivers, Ms. Cornell. Thank you so much for agreeing to present this matter in front of the community. Here at Central High School. And with that, you each will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you choose to use that, I believe the timer is up on the podium. I'm going to keep a timer up here. We usually have one in front of us, but I'll keep watch on it as well. All right, and with that, we're ready for argument.
Morning, Your Honor. My name is Bruce Rivers. I represent Ms. Zetterwald. In this appeal, this is a tragic case of a homicide caused by drinking and driving. The appellant battled for years with depression and severe alcoholism. On July 21st, Ms. Zetterwald made a decision to drive drunk and she fatally injured an oncoming motorist. She ended that life and forever changed her life. She was severely injured in the crash and she was hospitalized. And this was the beginning of her road to recovery. In August of 2022, Ms. Zetterwald was charged with criminal vehicular homicide, and unlike the case in Gebeck, where the defendant had stipulated facts about, Ms. Zetterwald actually entered a guilty plea, fully and wholeheartedly accepted responsibility. Ms. Zetterwald entered into and successfully completed two treatment programs. She received treatment for depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. At the time of the sentencing, she had been sober for more than a year. She was attending AA on a regular basis, had a sponsor, a supportive sober community and family, and she was attending, she had maintained her sobriety in all the conditions that the court had imposed. The defense in this case clearly, clearly demonstrated that Ms. Zetterwald was particularly amenable to probation. Her recovery after such a long history of alcoholism and severe alcoholism, along with mental health challenges, was substantial, life-changing, and compelling. Now, the defense in this case asked the court for a downward dispositional departure. The guidelines called for a prison sentence of 41 to 57 months. And our argument here today is that the district court in this case did not properly analyze the trauma factors. In fact, the court was severely dismissive. And you can't really glean from the transcript the tenor of the court's tone, but it was delivered at a high anxious rate. The court asked her to recite the first two steps of the AA pledge. And one of the things about this defendant, she had PTSD and very severe mental health. She was in treatment and she was also on disability. And the court sort of used her infirmity against her at the moment. It was a cynical attack in the appellate. And I would argue an abuse of the court's power.
Mr. Rivers, let me ask you about the district court's inquiry for performance. I do want to acknowledge that it is clear from this record that your client did undertake significant steps to try to control her alcoholism and address the issues that brought her into this position when she was in the district court. But when I read the pre-sentence investigation report, it does indicate that over the course of her adult life, she had many opportunities to engage in treatment. In fact, in 2014, it looks to me that she did go to AA for a while, but then admitted to the investigator that she was just going through the motions and it was not something that she was really engaged in. So when I consider what Judge Cahill was doing at the district court, it looks to me like he's trying to determine whether your client was just going through the motions this time too, like she admitted she had done in the past. So why is that an abuse of discretion at the district court?
It was really the way he did it.
Tell me about that.
His volume at which you can't tell it from the record, but the volume at which he imparted his messaging flustered her and really turned her into a panic state and put her on the spot. And she had those, she had PTSD, she had other mental health problems that were undiagnosed back in 2014, which was 8 years earlier. I think we demonstrated through our motion and the things that we did that was submitted to the court for medical records and so on, that she had some undiagnosed mental health treatment problems in addition to the alcohol. And she was addressing both of those, which was a far different thing than she had ever done.
And so what are we to do with that? And I understand, having been a district court judge, that it is nerve-wracking for people to appear at sentencing and be examined by a judge in a very stressful point in their life. But what are we to do with on appeal when we're on an abuse of discretion standard of review? How do we consider district court's volume or its tone when that's not a case?
I'm nervous right now.
We're friendly.
Right. Well, one of the things that you can do, the appellate courts may vacate and modify a sentence on many grounds, the sentence is unreasonable, inappropriate, or that such a result is fairness and uniformity. That's how State versus Bass is.
Counsel, what about the sentence makes it unusual or inappropriate when it is a guideline sentence under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines?
The uniformity. And by that, I mean, sometimes what happens is you get the sentence you want depending upon the judge that you're in front of. You could have a judge that is, that's a great trial judge, or that's a good sentencing judge. And if you look at the sentences in GEBEC, I think that's how you pronounce it, G-E-B-E-C-K, that was Judge Toussaint that departed down. In that case, we didn't even have a plea. It was a stipulated facts trial. Is it fair that the same set of circumstances in front of one judge could result in a non-prison sentence, as opposed to the same set of circumstances to another judge results in a prison sentence.
And I think the law would say, no, it's not, which is precisely why the Minnesota sentencing guidelines were enacted, to ensure that similarly situated people who commit the same offense with the same criminal history receive the same sentence. That's why the presumptive sentence is the appropriate one. And only in rare extenuating circumstances is there to be a departure from that presumptive sentence. So your points are well taken, but the best way to ensure that there is uniform, consistent sentencing is to follow the sentencing guidelines and to rarely make exceptions. Given that that is the state of our sentencing law here in Minnesota, on what basis would we say this judge used his discretion by refusing to depart from the sentence that's presumed by law for any person who was similarly situated to your client?
Well, if you follow that logic all the way through, then nobody can qualify for departure necessarily.
That's supposed to be the idea, that very few people qualify for departure.
But what is the incentive then pre-trial for anybody to rehab and to pick up, you know, the pieces and change their life? Law enforcement intervention in a lot of cases saves lives. And getting somebody off the street with a threat of prison to instill change is what I think was what happened in this case. And
that seems to be a policy decision, and it's a well-taken policy decision, and sort of thing that the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is continually evaluating what is a just and appropriate sentence for any given offense. But as judges, we don't make the policy, we follow the policy, we follow the law. And when we're reviewing another judge's sentencing decision, we can't simply say, well, we disagree, we would have granted it. Sure, that's not our role. We really need a significant abuse of discretion to reverse a sentence. What is that significant abuse of discretion here?
Well, I think the analysis that the court did here is went on her past as opposed to what, which is only one of the factors, and I think he relied too heavily on the past. But in talking about the rarity of granting a reversal, in Kingdom, the 1981 case, the court said, we do not intend to entirely close the door on appeals from refusals to depart. However, they don't tell you what would open the door to that.
Well, doesn't Curtis tell us that? I mean, I can think of one case in which our court has reversed refusal to depart. And that's a case where we had an 18-year-old person who I think took a case of beer from someone's breezeway. He was charged with burglary and he was sent to prison for that offense with no record. And I think in Curtis, what we said is the judge abused his discretion by failing to exercise discretion. In other words, the judge didn't consider the reasons to depart, not to depart, weigh those, and make a decision. So that case stands for the proposition that there is no abuse of discretion so long as the judge considers the arguments for and against departure in making this decision. What do you point to that would allow us to conclude that Judge Cahill did not consider the arguments and evidence from the state, the arguments and evidence from yourself, weigh that evidence, and arrive at a decision that reflects his exercise of discretion as a judge in that community?
One of the things that the judge did say is just basically a sort of a remark that almost throws up his hands where he says, you know, all I see is what you've done in the past. The past is a predictor of the future, basically, is what he said. And it seemed like it didn't matter what she had done in the future. He was never going to grant the departure option. So it seemed like it was a very insincere or he just made his decision based on her past. And I think that is not what the trial factors are. And, you know, there were so many other factors that he didn't consider when making his decision.
Can I just reference one other piece of the record that was at least troubling to me? And that is, there was a comment at the conclusion of the pre-sentence investigation report, and I know the client expressed her remorse in many different ways throughout the proceedings, including before Judge Cahill. But the impression that apparently the PSI writer had was that your client was not remorseful during that interview process. And I think the remark was that it was remarkable and for lack of remorse, or is the writer's perception of lack of remorse. Why isn't that fact in the record also germane to the district court's decision that she's not particularly amenable to probation? It is a trial.
It absolutely is. And she expressed her remorse. She did express her remorse in the PSI. And she's quoted in the PSI as saying that she, you know, felt bad for the family. She wished it was her. I mean, she said a lot of those things. Her affect, quite frankly, makes you think that she's not serious. But that's a mental health, and it's a very subjective thing, and I think that was used against her. At every stage of these proceedings, she was respectful of the court, respectful of the family, mindful of the person that was injured or that lost her life in this case. And she made the changes. So that's all I have. Was, if you have any other questions?
I'm not anything to do with the panel. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Rivers. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to do so. Thank you. Ms. Cormier, I'm just going to reset my 1 o'clock here. Anytime you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. As opposing counsel discussed, the unfortunate reality of this case is that appellant drove while highly intoxicated. She crashed into one vehicle, crashed into Adam Madsen's vehicle, and killed Adam Madsen. After entering a straight guilty plea for doing so, the Honorable Peter Cahill sentenced her to a guideline sentence of 57 months in prison, which is where appellant is currently seated. Under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, that sentence is presumptively appropriate. It is appellant's burden to prove that Judge Cahill abused his discretion in sentencing appellant to a presumptively appropriate sentence. That's a very high bar.
What was the criminal history score of that sentencing?
Zero.
So first offense, no record, presumptive prison on this offense.
Correct. And if Your Honor wants to know the presumptive range, it is, I believe, 41 to 57 with a presumptive guideline sentence of 48. But again, this is still
the so he sets at the top of the range?
He did. And Your Honor, again, this appeal regards the district court's exercise of discretion here. Your Honor, Judge Larkin did bring up State versus Curtis, and in that case, that was a case where the district court did not exercise its discretion in sentencing, and that's not the issue that we have before this court today. Clearly, Judge Cahill carefully considered the entire record, and Judge Cahill was present at both the plea hearing and at the sentencing hearing, so he was able to judge appellant's affects for himself. And since opposing counsel brought up appellant's affect, I do just want to note that appellant's affect seems to have been sort of equivocal on the issue of remorse, not just in court on the record where a courtroom is sort of a stressful setting. In her PSI interview, that's pre-sentence investigation interview, she also exhibited those same behaviors, and yet it wasn't the same setting. It wasn't a stressful setting. That's a one-on-one conversation here. And so what we see from the record is that the district court considered her affect at all stages of the proceeding, whether or not that was in court or not.
I mean, if I'm maybe recasting Mr. Rivers' argument a little bit, perhaps the pressure point here is that the district court may have discounted her affect or her mental illness or her condition and not taken into account that the effect of her medical history on potentially some of the other factors that are typically considered by a district court in assessing particular amenability to probation. So what do we do with that? What do we do with that?
I dispute that characterization of the record here. The judge who issued appellant's sentence is a very experienced district court judge. This is not the first mentally ill defendant that Judge Cahill has ever sentenced. There's no indication in the record that her mental illness or her physical abilities were discounted at sentencing. They were certainly considered. That's what this court can assume from the evidence. Judge Cahill did consider the entire record.
So, Counselor, excuse me for interrupting you, but if you would answer Judge Grish's question, particularly in light of how the district court questioned Ms. Edelwall about the AA 10 steps. I mean, I think that's the part of the argument that we're hearing from appellant that the district court didn't for Ms. Edelwall's vulnerability. No, I'll just speak as loud as I can. I think I finished my question. So.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. What I think Your Honor's question is sort of getting at is how much of appellant's inability to recite the first two steps of AA, which she claimed to have been studying daily for a year, how much of a role did that play in Judge Cahill's sentencing decision? And I would argue that it is minor. I think it could be a good assessment, you know, on average for an average defendant, especially one who claims that they study the principles of AA daily for a year. I think that's a valid question that Judge Cahill could have asked. There's no allegation that Judge Cahill abused his discretion in asking such a question. So I do think it's a fair question. But to get to the point, how much did that actually play a role in his sentencing decision? I don't think the record shows that it plays that big of a role considering the posture of this case here. We have a defendant who was sentenced to a guideline sentence, which is presumptively appropriate. It was appellant's burden to prove that she should be on probation instead of prison, and she failed to do so.
Stop you there with the question. So you established defendant has a criminal history score of zero, prior DWIs, accident, death, the presumptive sentence is committed to prison. So run the sentencing guidelines, and almost every third meeting, at the end of the meeting in the public comments section, members of the public complain that they've lost a loved one to a drunk driver, and that person gets probation. And why don't we have greater sanctions? And why isn't there a consequence? So I'm led to believe that departures are regularly granted in these cases. Do you have any idea what the departure rate is for a person in this circumstance? In other words, Mr. Rivers is arguing, well, there's presumptive sentence, but then there's what really happens, and why would we have a situation where he cites one case where this person had a prior DWI, had a second DWI, killed somebody, got probation. His client has no criminal history, has done all this treatment. She doesn't get probation. What's the departure rate like in your experience for this offense in your community, Hennepin County?
I am not aware of any particular numbers or rate to get to.
Just practically, do you see people getting departures in these cases?
You know, it's hard to say. In my criminal appellate practice, I can tell you that I have never seen a case where this court or the Supreme Court has held what appellant's position is here on appeal, and that is for a presumptive guideline sentence, which is imposed on a CVH, a criminal vehicular homicide where someone dies, and the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court reversed that sentence, left that perpetrator out of prison and put them back in the community. I've never seen that on appeal. And if that exists, I assume appellant would have cited it in her brief. I didn't come across that in my research. The one time I did, other than Curtis, the other case that comes to mind is State versus Hennum, H-E-N-N-U-M. And in that case, that was not a dispositional departure sentencing appeal. Instead, that was a durational departure. And in that case, I think the district court sentenced to a guideline sentence, and it went to the Supreme Court, which said that because battered women syndrome was at play in the case, then that defendant was entitled to a durational departure, which is distinguishable from what we have here. That is the only other case that comes to mind.
Was there a plea negotiation in this case?
It was a straight plea run, straight plea to all three offenses.
So she really had nothing to gain and everything to lose.
It's hard for me to answer that question because, in my opinion, this appellant was expecting Judge Cahill to issue probation. And I don't know what the expectations were there, but that just wasn't appropriate in this case.
It does seem a little surprising to me that she received top of the box with no record, but neither here nor there. Just odd given the lack of any concession for a straight up guilty plea case that case.
What I will say is Judge Cahill did explain that decision as well on the record.
And what is the explanation?
And the
not that he needs to, but right. What was it?
The explanation, and I apologize if the feedback is coming from my pen. But,
I moved as well, so okay.
Judge Cahill carefully considered the record in this case, and I do think that's apparent just from the plain transcripts. But when appellant was requesting the sentence that she felt like she deserved for this offense, she moved for both a durational departure and a dispositional departure. And so based on the severity of the offense, which is a consideration for a district court to consider when faced with a durational departure motion, and based on the blood alcohol content of the appellant at the time she killed Adam Madsen, it's higher than it was in Quebec. It is, I think,
over twice the legal limit, right?
Yes, and I'm not going to say the blood alcohol content because that's part of confidential medical records which were filed, but Your Honor is well aware that it is. I think Judge Cahill's word was alarmingly high or surprisingly high, and it was so high that top of the box seemed appropriate. And then Judge Cahill was also considering, are we doing probation? Are we doing prison here? And then, so to the extent that those analyses were separate, that is the analysis that Judge Cahill gave for declining to durationally depart as a con requested.
I am concerned that the answers that the appellant gave to the AA questions were not entirely incorrect. They may not have been precisely the first two steps of the 12 steps, but they weren't so far away from what those are that the conclusion that Judge Cahill seems to have drawn that she didn't know, she wasn't familiar with the 12 steps, could potentially be clearly erroneous, which would be another grounds to determine there was an abuse of discretion here. Do you want to comment on that, the substance of those responses?
I do. First, I think Your Honor is correct in shaping that as an allegation of a clearly erroneous finding. And I do want to note that appellant does not frame an issue that way. Appellant does not.
I understand.
Yes. But with if this court were to assume without deciding that a clearly erroneous finding was made or that question resulted in some erroneous discussion on the record as it relates to an abuse of discretion, this court can just disregard that and look at the rest of the record and still affirm Judge Cahill's sentence here. That's what this court typically does when a clearly erroneous finding is made on like a probable cause determination or some other type of determination. This court then eliminates that and looks at the rest of the record and sees if there is enough to affirm the sentence in that case or whatever the determination would be. And so let's remove that entirely. And again, respondent's position is that was all appropriate and above board. But if you were to sort of remove that consideration, the entire AA discussion, there is still plenty in the record to allow Judge Cahill to determine that remorse was disingenuous or that she was just checking boxes to use Judge Cahill's language.
Was the victim involved at sentencing?
There certainly was.
And what was that, just very summarily?
Requesting the most severe sentence possible and explaining the demeanor that Adam Madsen's family observed of the appellant at prior hearings to sentencing. Which is very concerning, and I encourage the court to review those sentences that I did include in my brief. I have so many tangents that I would like to sort of weave together here at the end. But there are other indicia in the record that appellant was checking boxes and just going through the motions here. As a preliminary point, appellant argues that Judge Cahill should not have looked at appellant's past behavior to determine the appropriate sentence in this case, and I've never seen that as a holding in any case law that I have read. But in addition, if you look at just the trial factors, the district court has to look at behavior between plea and sentencing to help determine what sentence is appropriate. And some of the trial factors are cooperation in court. What is her attitude in court? What has she done to improve herself such that the district court's public safety concerns could be assuaged by a probationary sentence? But again, looking at the record evidence that appellant was going through the motion here, the court has already brought up the PSI writer's notes, that the PSI writer is alarmingly concerned that appellant never grasped the severity of the offense, that she did not have expressed genuine remorse. And again, that's in the PSI evaluation setting, not in the district court setting. I think it's also telling that appellant alleged to the PSI writer that no further programming is necessary for her throughout the rest of her life to help support her chemical dependency and mental health concerns, which are pretty severe, according to what I've heard from opposing counsel this morning. It's also alarming in the PSI that appellant states she wasn't even feeling intoxicated on the day that she killed that person with her vehicle. Also alarming is that appellant never expressed sort of a genuine plan for herself if probation were ordered in this case. So all of those factors, even if you set aside the very brief AA conversation at sentencing, all of that still supports a finding that, you know, remorse is, I think I have about 22 seconds left. And I had some other remarks prepared, but if your honors don't have any other questions, I respectfully request that this court affirm Judge Cahill's sentence of 57 months in prison.
Thank you very much, Ms. Quinn. Mr. Rivers, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
The court had asked a question about departures and the rarity of them, and how they naturally happen on the road. I do know that as a practitioner, generally speaking, I've been doing this 26 years, and certain types of cases, I can guarantee you, if I do X, Y, and Z, and all throughout the process, I get a departure. Almost every single time. And the court generally respects those. And in this case, I was absolutely shocked that she got a top of the guideline sentence. When you have a plea, an admission of guilt, and you've had a year's worth of sobriety, there was absolutely no concession in this sentence whatsoever.
Was it a shift jail credit?
She had about 12 days, I think, or something like that. Or no, maybe it was just a couple days, but she turned her, she was in the ICU. And then she was charged shortly after she was in ICU, and she turned herself in. And this whole notion that the PSI writer is saying that she was unremorseful and whatever is so subjective, because I obviously I had many conversations with her that are not in the record, but Ms. Setterwall expressed it to the court. She expressed it to the PSI writer. And this notion that she, in 2014, she was going through the motions, I think was a candid admission that she hadn't taken her alcoholism seriously. And so the whole checking the boxes, you know, you don't get to where she was and be sober for a year if you're not serious about it. She didn't have any new offenses. And I guess we're not really here to sit here and re-argue my disposition of the departure motion, which I'm kind of doing, I guess. But It just seemed to me that, that Judge Cahill relied way too much on her past and not on the other factors. Because when all the other factors are balanced out, it seems to me that she definitely, I just know in my heart of hearts that with another judge, I would have gotten the departure. And so that whole disparity argument, it is an issue with how our system is set up, but that is what it is.
What's the other offense? You said there are certain offenses. I know my client is X, Y, and Z. We'll get a departure. I'm just curious.
Well, child pornography, for example. It's child pornography is a very low-level offense. And the way those are charged out, it's per image. So you can have somebody with no criminal history have 17 counts. And if I get them in to get a psychosexual evaluation, get them into treatment, and usually it takes a while for the forensics to happen. So 18 months later, they get charged, and they've already gone through treatment, they haven't reoffended, and I have never had a case where I didn't get a departure in district court until they reoffended. So that's all I have. I appreciate the school. I appreciate the justices here and opposing counsel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel, for your helpful arguments today and your submission. The matter is taken under advisement. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time period, which is 90 days in this case. I want to thank both of you for your excellent advocacy today and for coming to Central High School. And with that, we will stand in recess.